This is an interview with Gary Johnson at the University of Montana on July 21, 1984, during the Smoke Jumper reunion. The interviewer is Renee Guo. Okay, I want to first ask you what attracted you to smoke jumping.
I was going to school and needed to make a little bit of money in a short period of time.
Mm-hmm. Who exposed you to the smoke jumping organization?
Well, I had a supervisor on a fire crew that I worked on down in California, and he was a jumper, and then his supervisor was a jumper, and that's how I sent an application in.
So you had worked for the Forest Service before you were a smoke jumper. How old were you when you first started smoke jumping?
23.
What base did you train at?
Redding, down in Northern California.
Mm-hmm. How many years did you work as a smoke jumper?
16, and I still am.
How did your family feel about your becoming a smoke jumper?
Didn't bother them a bit. I was married, had been married for about 4 years before I even got into the program. So we knew each other pretty good. And didn't have any children at that time. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if she thought I was going to continue on, you know, whether it was just a 2 or 3 year lark, but it wasn't for me, and she doesn't have too many complaints right now, as far as I know. So, no problems at all.
Great. What kind of training did you have before you started to jump?
What kind of training?
What kind of training did the Smoke Jumper organization give you before you actually jumped out of the plane?
Oh, just normal, I think it was 160 hours of some of our unit training that every jumper has to go through, and then certain academic classroom type training. Mm-hmm. And it lasted about 2 weeks prior to our first training jumps. I don't think it's any different than anybody else.
Right. Did you feel well prepared before you made your first jump?
Yes.
Do you remember what your first jump was like?
Yeah, I guess I do. This was early in the morning, and I had been coached to what to expect, so it was pretty much like everybody told me it was going to be like, and hit the ground and wanted to do it again.
Mm-hmm. Great. What was your first fire jump like?
My first fire jump was what is commonly known as a crew action or a large fire, and there was 16 of us on it, and it was up on the Klamath National Forest in Northern California, right next to the Oregon border. Mm-hmm. And it was just it was probably a 25 or 30 acre fire up in the wilderness area, and we worked on it all night and walked out the next day. It was some of the things I remember about it was there was an old phone line, and some of the other new people hit the phone line and they hit the ground. You don't know where the jump spot is when you first go out at that time, because you only thing you want to do is just get out of the airplane.
Mm-hmm. What kind of equipment do you carry on your body when you jump?
Well, we've got the protective equipment, the suit, the Nomex heavily padded suit, helmet. Mm-hmm. It's very similar to a motorcycle helmet with a screen type mask, and then a harness that holds you to the parachute, and a reserve parachute, an emergency parachute, and a PG bag, a personal gear bag, mm-hmm. that you carry all your own personal equipment, jackets, socks, you know, maybe a little extra food, mm-hmm. you know, special food that you might want. Mm-hmm. Total is probably about 60 or 70 pounds.
Hmm. What kind of parachute do you use?
Down in Redding, we're 100% using the FS-12 at this time. We're no longer using the FS-10, which is still an approved canopy. We've got enough of the new ones that we want to go ahead and use the new ones, hopefully to prevent injuries.
Mm-hmm. What kind of devices do these new ones have on them that the old ones don't that would prevent injuries?
Well, it's the design of the canopy is such that the aerodynamics, the way it flies, and the way how fast you come down, your descent rate, is such that you don't hit as hard. Mm-hmm. And you can do a few more things as far as maneuvering goes. I mean, you can get into tighter spots and quicker turns and flatter turns, which all these things add up to if you have somebody that knows how to use it, what your training is develops that, will decrease your injury rate, and it's already been proven statistically mm-hmm. that it does.
Mm-hmm. Would you say that these parachutes are noticeably more safe than the dairy slot parachutes that we use?
No, I wouldn't say that. Not the dairy slot. That's uh-huh. You're talking two or three generations back now.
Right.
And no, the 5A, FS-5A, and then the FS-5, and then you're getting beyond my my experience, and you talk much later than that, earlier than that. No, I would say that the FS-5A or the dairy slotted type canopies are probably comparable. Mm-hmm. But as far as how easy they let you down, I mean, you know, you don't slam into the ground quite as hard. But the new one allows you to manipulate it mm-hmm. a little bit better, and you don't won't hang up in a tree mm-hmm. where you would with the dairy slotted canopy. Mm-hmm. It's a little quicker responding, mm-hmm. but it can also get you in trouble too because of that. Mm-hmm. If you don't know what you're doing with it.
Do you often get hung up in trees?
Personally?
Yeah.
No. I don't jump as much as I used to. Uh-huh. For me personally, I haven't been hung up in a tree in a very, very long, long time.
Mm-hmm. Do other smoke jumpers who are using these new parachutes get hung up in trees as often as...
Yeah, I don't think that has really changed that much mm-hmm. because you still have a level of... expertise or experience mm-hmm. that it's going to take a person 4 or 5 years before he really knows what he's doing with that parachute, and so you're still going to have the mistakes mm-hmm. that will end up being in trees. Mm-hmm. So down in California we don't have all the little nice openings and meadows like some of the other regions do. You can't say it a blanket, but we probably have more than our share of people hanging in trees because we just have more trees to jump into. Mm-hmm.
How many years then have you actively worked as a smoke jumper as opposed to doing any other kind of work with the smoke jumper organization? For 16 or?
Oh yeah, I'm still an active jumper.
Uh-huh. Do you have some type of other role other than just a smoke jumper?
Within the Forest Service? Uh-huh. No, that's my primary responsibility down at the jump base in Redding. Mm-hmm. I have some other duties mm-hmm. at the base itself. Take care of the maintenance of the facility and stuff. But no, that's my most important job.
Mm-hmm. How many smoke jumpers do you have?
40.
Are there any women smoke jumpers?
Yes, yes. At Reading, we have one female jumper.
Mm-hmm. How long has she been?
This is her second year.
Mm-hmm. How do you feel about having women in the smoke jumper?
It doesn't make any difference to me as long as I can get them to do the kind of work that they're supposed to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what does bother me is if whoever the powers, people in the higher up management positions,
mm-hmm.
our Washington office people, our regional office people, and in some cases our forest level people, our zones,
mm-hmm.
Elect to dictate to you who you're going to hire and what standards you're going to hire under, and then. I'll give you an example. We had this year we had no need to hire new people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, first year jumpers, we didn't have any need for it because we had had a full quota of returnees. But I was mandated to make an offer to three people in order to reach a female on our cert.
Mm-hmm.
And our certificate of eligible candidates, mm-hmm. what a cert is. And I was not very happy about it, to say the least. Not because we were doing it to get the female, but the
mm-hmm.
fact that we didn't need to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went ahead and hired made offers to three people,
mm-hmm.
the female being the third person on the list. We had a veteran, which you have to hire a veteran. Then we had a white male, and we had the he rated out higher than the female, and then the female was the third on our list. So we made offers to three people, and the female turned it down, and the white male turned it down. The veteran we did get on board.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he came up here to Missoula. You know, we didn't want to put a training session on for just one person because they're kind of expensive to put on.
Mm-hmm.
And so I talked to the jump base up here in Missoula, and we sent him up here to go through their training with their people. He got hurt, and so as a this is all we didn't even need him,
mm-hmm.
but he got hurt. Now the federal government is paying his doctor bills, paying his wages for X number of weeks until he becomes able to perform his work again,
mm-hmm.
and that was that's coming into literally thousands and thousands of dollars that we didn't need to spend, but we had to because of trying to recruit a woman.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was, you never hear anybody admit to that.
Right.
At all.
Right.
But that's the reason.
Mm-hmm.
But like the female jumper we have now, her second year, I've got a tremendous amount of respect for her. She went through training here in Missoula 3 years ago and washed out. And, I went out of my way. I called up, not that I should get a pat on the back for this, but
right.
I called up her previous, she is from California.
Mm-hmm.
So I called up her previous supervisor, who I'm pretty close friends with, and I said, why don't you have her send an application into Reading? I had talked to him several months before that, and he wanted to know why we don't ever get any applications from him. He's got a hotshot crew down there in Southern California. Some pretty well-known, hard-working hotshot crews, and they really have sent us some good people. And had several females on his crew for the previous 5 or 6 years, and they all came up here.
Mm-hmm.
We never saw any of them down and apply to Reading.
Mm-hmm.
So I had called them up and kind of chewed them out. I said, how come you don't tell those women to apply at Reading?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, well, they think you're a bunch of rednecks or something like that, which is a bunch of baloney, but story he told me.
Right.
And so after I found out that this female had washed out in Missoula, and she picked up on the IR crew or something around here, and that winter I called the same fellow up again down in Southern California, and I asked him, have you seen, her name's Price, have you seen Price lately? He said, well, yeah, she comes in every once in a while. I said, are you going to have her, tell her to send an application? And she did, and we selected her. But I had a reason for doing that, too. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ensure that when I got her, I had done a lot of checking. We do a whole bunch of screening of our, but particularly our new people, first-year jumpers. But we're after the best we can get.
Right.
And I had done that with Price. I talked to the jumpers here, put her through the training, but she didn't quite make it. I had talked to several other supervisors she worked for, so I knew what kind of person she was. Mm-hmm. And she sent an application in, and we hired her. And we had 12 or 13 going through the training at that time. And if you wanted to rate her numerically, she'd probably be in the upper one half to upper third, both physically and mental attitude. Mm-hmm. She was hired under our old standards. You know, we have height and weight standards. Mm-hmm. Nationally.
What are those standards?
Well, they when we hired the first female in Reading, mm-hmm. Price, Diane Price, she was hired under the same standards that I was hired under, mm-hmm. At that time, 14 years ago. And everybody's before then and everybody after then up until 2 years ago. And they changed the standards to broaden it, to allow a larger population to at least have a chance of becoming a jumper. And it was primarily to get minorities and women, allow them to get into the program. And but she was hired under those existing standards. Mm-hmm. And she did an excellent job through the training. In fact, her first year, she had the longest pack out, her and two other fellows, mm-hmm. the longest pack out of the year for us down at Reading. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, she's doing a real good job, mm-hmm. and I just popped my buttons over it, really.
Right.
I'm really, really proud of her.
Great.
So, but, it, you know, really it comes down to this, she would, you know, whether she was purple or black, white.
Right.
Female, male, hermaphrodite, whatever you want to
right.
call her, she'd be a good jumper.
Right.
That's how I looked at her. Mm-hmm. But I do get a little heartburn sometimes over some of the things that go on, and we're the jumpers themselves, that each individual unit is losing more and more the ability to select their own people. And in Reading, we're a small unit. And we've got pretty good rapport with the region and the forest right there in Reading. So we've been able to hang on to it and have and maintain the control. And we still can get the kind of people we want. And we don't spin our wheels a lot on people that aren't going to make it through the program. Mm-hmm. You know, you hire 20 people and you only get three, that's very expensive. Mm-hmm. And it's time consuming. Mm-hmm. And it's also hard on the people that don't make it through the program. They don't have a job. Whereas if they would have waited a year or two till they either had more experience or physically build up a little bit for it, they'd be better off. If somebody's pushed them into the program before they're ready, it does harm to both, I think, the jumper program and to the individual. Because, mm-hmm. you know, the way the government hires, if you don't get your application in soon enough, you don't get a job. Mm-hmm. And if you go get selected for a jumper position and you wash out 2 weeks into the program, it's going to be darn hard to find another job because mm-hmm. the season's already started and all the other forests have already hired all the people. Mm-hmm. Maybe different up here in Region 1 in Missoula, but down in Region 5, I can't guarantee anybody's going to have a job. Mm-hmm. They'll make it through the program.
What were the old height and weight standards?
Okay, you asked me that before. Yeah, the up until 3 years ago, the height limitations, you had to be at least 5'5", either 5'4 or 5'5", and as a minimum, and you couldn't be any taller than 6'3". And the weight standards were a minimum weight of 130 pounds and a max of 190 for a first year jumper and 200 for an experienced jumper. Why a double standard at the other end, I'm not real sure. I've been told it was because the extra 10 pounds that the experienced jumper carried was made up for by his experience. I don't know if I'd buy that or not. That's what they were.
Uh-huh.
And we had eyesight requirements and hearing requirements. And,
right.
And like any kind of job, whether it's a fireman, any kind of physical type work,
mm-hmm.
they normally have some kind of standards they hire by.
Mm-hmm. What are the new standards?
The present standards are a minimum height of 5 foot, so decreased 4 or 5 inches,
mm-hmm.
and a maximum height of 6'5", so it increased 2 inches. And then the weight went down to 120 pounds minimum to 200 pounds across the board, maximum.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got PT requirements to the physical fitness
right.
test.
So that means that there might be somebody who's 120 pounds that's has to at one point carry out a pack that might be 100 or 120 pounds.
Or 130 or 140. And that was our. So I happened to be on a committee that met here at Fort Missoula 2 winters ago, and that's when we reevaluated our standards.
Mm-hmm.
And we took a look at our existing standards, which were the 5'4", 5'5", 6'3", and those things, and said, well, what can we stretch those? We had to come up with a why do you have those standards? And if you do have standards, why? What are your reasons for having them?
Mm-hmm.
And so we had a package we put together about that thick of justification for, we did change some of the standards. We kept some of them the same, and we tightened some of them.
Do you think that this change in standards will help to improve the body of smoke jumpers?
I don't know. What I don't want it to do, I don't want it to lower our efficiency and safety.
Mm-hmm.
And that bothers me. And that the change in the standards, they're not set in concrete. They're what we're using now for hiring, but they're also being evaluated. And probably within, I would say, 2 to 5 years, we'll have enough data for keeping track of injuries, pack-out injuries, jump injuries, and tying it into the, it's all done on a computer, so I don't know how they're doing it, but we're filling out data sheets for every injury to see if, by following those standards, have we, in fact, cause more injuries. Some of that is going to be real hard. I don't know how you're going to, you know, like, you're talking a 120-pound person carrying out a 120-pound pack. That injury may not surface for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know, but you got to do something.
Right.
You got to track it somehow.
Right. How many smoke jumpers are there now in the country in 1 year?
I believe we're sitting right around 330 nationally, and I don't think that counts Alaska, the BLM jumpers up in Alaska.
Mm-hmm.
And we think we got about 140 or so at Missoula. There's about 45 in Redmond, Oregon, about 20 in Winthrop, 40 in and Reading, about 75, and McCall, whatever that adds up to.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's right around 330.
Mm-hmm. How many openings would you say there are a year, say, in the past few years?
What kind of openings?
For new jumpers.
Well, we, okay, just for first year jumpers. Let's see, we had, it fluctuates every year depending on what the previous year was like. You have a real busy fire season, you don't get much of a turnover. Everybody was there last year, really thought it was great, so they come back the following year. But we average in Redding six to eight new people a year, and sometimes we'll have zero, and sometimes we'll have 15. An average since I've been there would be 6 to 8. And I can't really speak for the other bases.
How many applicants do you have for roughly for those openings?
We have approximately, I'd say 400 apply. And out of that, we may have 100 to 120 that are qualified that we consider for positions. For Redding. That's just for Redding.
Right.
For 6 to 8 jobs.
So, it is a highly competitive.
Yes. Yes. And the economy has, you can really see a difference. It's the late 70s, early 80s. The economy had a tremendous effect on the number of people who applied. We had, when jobs got harder to get, our number of people that applied zoomed up. Mm-hmm. And now that this year, because the economy has picked up a little bit, seems that we didn't have quite as many people apply this year. Whether that's the reason or not, I don't know, but it sure ties in with the roof close.
Have you seen any changes in the smoke jumper organization other than the ones that we've talked about with sort of a quota system being established that particularly interest you or that you would like to talk about? Changes in the kind of people that are now smoke jumpers? Or
yeah, I guess I have, and I can, again, I can only speak for one region, California. And the thing that I, you know, and I don't know whether it's good or bad, but we seem to have more people that have been around for a lot longer in the jumper program. Whereas when I first started out, and first 3, 4, 5 seasons or years I was with the jumpers, we had pretty good turnover. That was the way we had our program set up. Everybody came in for 1 year, and then they went back to their forest that they worked on. It was a detailed program we had. And
Can I just ask a question?
Yeah.
Excuse me for interrupting, but what do you mean by a detailed program?
Okay, a detailed program is, and what I'm talking about there is down in California, the Redding jump base was unique at that time. It was a program that was started back in 1963. And what it was is we had a core of year-round jumpers there at Redding, sometimes as low as 2 or 3 and other times as high as 5 or 6 that were there every year.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd bring in each fire season, a tremendous amount of new people, 20, say. And we trained the 20. At that time, we were only about a 25-person unit. We weren't 40 back then, we were only 25. And those folks would go through the jumper training and be stationed at the base, at the jump base, for that summer, and they'd go out and jump fire. They were jumpers for 1 year, one season. And then when they got, and they were permanent employees of the forces. They had what we call appointments, and they went, and when they were through when fire season was over and we didn't have any more need for jumpers in California, they'd go back to their job on the forest or the ranger district, whether it be a slash foreman or a fire engine operator or a assistant fire management officer, whatever kind of job they had, they were detailed just for the fire season into the jumpers, went to the training, spent the season there, and went back out to their original job, which they kept open for them. And then the next year, we would do the same thing. We'd get some more of those kind of folks from other places, bring them in. In the meantime, the ones that jumped the year before, or 2 years before, 3 years before, starting in 1963, would come back to Reading for 1 week of training in the springtime and get refreshed and retrained. Then they'd go back out and do their job. And if we had a need to call them back in, if we had more fires than the 25 that we had there to handle, we could get on the phone, call those folks up, and they'd come in, they'd be qualified jumpers, and they'd back us up, give us help. And that program lasted until 1974. And to my knowledge, no other base has ever had a program like that. The thing that comes closest to it right now is what's going on right here in Region 1, where they farm out. We've got jumpers down in Hamilton, Coeur d'Alene, Plains. We've got their little spike bases set up, which is similar to it, but not quite. That we, you know, it was a very unique program, and supposedly it was kind of like a fire academy. Mm-hmm. They would come in for that season, they'd get all kinds of fire behavior training, mm-hmm. and law enforcement training, and crew foreman training, and when they got out that season, they supposedly had a stronger background in fire, and they could move on up the ladder, the management ladder, mm-hmm. and they got back up. That's what I meant by the detail program.
Right. Why was that program phased out?
Well, it was phased out for a couple of different reasons. One of them was that it wasn't as cost effective. I don't know whether that was a name somebody pulled out of the air just to say we don't want them and this is the reason, but it was a fairly expensive program because you had to bring them in for a week, and we had sometimes up to 60 people like that you have to put through training mm-hmm. every year. And so that was one thing that caused it was the cost-benefit deal. Mm-hmm. They weren't really making as many jumps as they should to justify the cost of training. Some of them, you know, we had people down in Southern California that came up. Mm-hmm. You know, they were all over the state. Mm-hmm. Another straw that broke that back, camel's back on that, was the need or the requirement to have a proficiency jump every so many weeks. Mm-hmm. It was every 14 days at that time. Mm-hmm. And prior to that, we didn't have a requirement like that. You made your three jumps, or two jumps is all it was qualified, required to be requalified mm-hmm. in the springtime, and then you never, all the rest of your jumps were fire jumps. Mm-hmm. You didn't have to make any more jumps. But right around 73 or 74, they came up with this proficiency requirement where every 2 weeks you had to have, if you didn't make a fire jump, you had to make a practice jump. And so it was kind of unmanageable to bring those folks back in every 2 weeks mm-hmm. or take an airplane to where they were. Mm-hmm. So that kind of knocked the program.
What do most of your smoke jumpers do in other seasons of the year now?
Well, Reading, like I said, we have 40 jumpers there, and 8 of them are work year-round right there at the base. Mm-hmm. And so that leaves us right around 30 to 35, that don't work year-round. Mm-hmm. And of that, we've got, just like any other jumper unit, kind of some unique individuals. Mm-hmm. And we've got one fellow sets up parties for Hollywood. I mean, he knows all a bunch of movie stars down there in L.A. And then we've got another guy that's a professional rock climber. He goes down to South America or wherever he can get away for.
Right.
Climbs rocks, skiers, mm-hmm. quote, world travelers, unquote.
Right.
A lot of them are busy trying to make a buck, too, in the wintertime.
Mm-hmm.
We have a longer season than most other units.
What is your fire season?
Well, normally about, we start gearing up. We have people available by the first week of May. And most other places are middle of June.
Mm-hmm.
And we started going on fires about that. First of May to the middle of May. And normally, if you consider Southern California, you know, I've spent many Thanksgivings down in Southern California on fires.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a good 6 months.
Yeah. Wouldn't you say that fire season is almost twice as long as ours here?
Yes.
Do you feel that having people come back year after year changes the kind of vigor
yes.
in the program?
That's what we were talking about before you asked me about the detail,
uh-huh.
I think. Yeah, you get a new person, a new jumper, first-year jumper, is a pleasure to be around. Because they're enthusiastic and they'll do they'll sweep floors, they'll clean heads, they don't care what it is. They're just raring to go and willing to help any way they can.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a real pleasure to supervise people like that. And then they roll along at about their third or fourth year, depending on the individual. But right about then they start to almost starting to be more trouble than they're worth, and so that's what's happened now in Redding is we're getting more and more people that have 8, 9, 10 seasons,
mm-hmm.
and they're really not doing themselves any good because they're still just working 5.5 to 6 months a year as a temporary. They don't have any kind of security,
mm-hmm.
Really no guarantee they're gonna have a job next year,
mm-hmm.
and we have more and more of that because we don't have that detail program anymore, and it's you have a level of expertise there as far as doing the smoke jumper job.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have the worries as far as that goes, but it's the other little things, the mundane project work around the base that really, to me, makes a difference on an individual. Anybody can, when it's everything's busy and it's hot and heavy and moving fast.
Right.
Anybody can shine in that situation,
mm-hmm.
because that's what they're here for in the first
right.
place. But what it really tells is when it's slow, when there's nothing going on, and you got the work to do, but it's not the most interesting work in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the difference I see. Our average age has increased for our crew.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's over 30 years old now,
mm-hmm.
for our jumpers. Our number of seasons has increased too, but seasons of experience.
Right. Hmm. Do you see any changes that might alter this tendency for the organization to become more of a career for someone instead of a seasonal job?
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's some light at the end of the tunnel, what I think one of the reasons is I see it that way is because of the active recruitment of females in minorities.
Mm-hmm.
I see that as there's a lot of people that are going to complain about that,
mm-hmm.
and especially some of the old timers.
Mm-hmm.
But boy, there's some silver linings to that quote dark cloud unquote, if you want to look at it that
mm-hmm.
way. And I see that as a good, as a positive for the program.
Mm-hmm.
Just like the lightening our pack out loads.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to benefit everybody.
Right.
And that's the same way with the career
mm-hmm.
opportunities.
How
and boy, if you're going to have to do it, if they're going to make you do it, you might as well get everything out of it you can.
Right, right. You mentioned your pack-out loads being lightened. how is that going to come about?
Well, just it's going to cost money.
Mm-hmm.
Just going to state-of-the-art materials. As you know, most of the jumper bases manufacture all their own equipment. I don't know if you know that or not, but yeah, they've all. You ever been out to a jumper base?
Mm-hmm. Okay. I've been out to the one in
Missoula. Uh-huh. Oh, you see all the sewing machines.
Right.
And everything. And we manufacture most of the stuff. Each base has not quite as, maybe not quite as big as Missoula is because they've got more jumpers. But each base has a similar setup. And so we're in the process right now. We're about a year into it, probably 3 years away from knocking a good 20, 25 pounds off of the loads that our jumpers carry out of the woods.
Exactly. What things would you lighten, and what kind of materials would be changed?
Well, I would go to maybe some of the lighter nylons,
mm-hmm.
lighter than cotton.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the hardware that we use, we can go to lighter weight hardware.
Mm-hmm.
We've historically overbuilt a lot of things, you know, because you are in a the type of work where you don't want anything to fail on you, so you. One layer is good, you put two layers on,
mm-hmm.
and we're finding out that's not necessary, so we're losing weight that way. Taking a look at the equipment that we drop on the people on fires, the cargo they get,
mm-hmm.
Disposable type stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's expensive, like I said,
mm-hmm.
to do it,
mm-hmm.
but it's going to benefit everybody. It's going to not only allow maybe a larger population to try to get in the program, but it's going to extend the careers of a lot of the guys like me that aren't as young as they used to be.
Right. Would you say then that this may reduce the highly strenuous work that's
yeah.
involved?
Yeah. The one part of this job in my mind that somebody is not going to be able to do anything, you know, from fighting the fire to jumping out of an airplane to climbing a tree to whatever you're talking about, the one function, one part of this job that if you're going to be hitting your head against the concrete wall, not be able to do it,
mm-hmm.
just plain not be able to do it, is going to be the pack out. That'll do it to you. That's the hardest. In my mind, that's the most difficult part of the job.
Mm-hmm.
You get a lot of the other things done. It may take you a little longer, or you may tear a parachute up or something like
mm-hmm.
that, getting it out of a tree. But as far as coming close to not being able to do it, it's going to be carrying that weight out of the woods.
Hmm. How do you carry out the pack out system right now?
I mean, how do we pack all the gear out?
Right. What is the procedure for packing the gear out? Is a better question.
Well, I imagine each region is a little bit different,
mm-hmm.
you know, because they've got their own policies and personalities making those policies.
Mm-hmm.
But basically, anything that's dropped into you, if you can't burn it up, carry it out.
Mm-hmm.
And the instances where that may not be the case, where you may be able to bury it or something, is if it's in a wilderness area. And regardless of that, you wouldn't bury a parachute, you wouldn't bury, you know, stuff that you're going to use again.
Right.
And you load it all into a bag, and each base seems to have its own design for what they think is the best bag for carrying all that out.
Mm-hmm.
And load it all in the bag and hit the trail.
Mm-hmm. And is the material packed out to the nearest road and then left, or is the material packed out the whole way with the smoke jumper until?
Well, that's usually decided by the forest that you're on.
Mm-hmm.
If we were jumping out of here and we went up somewhere on the Lolo, the Lolo National Forest would say, well, if we want those jumpers to pack down trail XYZ to where it crosses the road, 7-0-3, we'll have a truck waiting up there.
Mm-hmm.
Or we want them to pack up the ridge. We've got a hell spot up there, and a helicopter will pick them up. Or we'll get a pack train coming in to pick up your gear. Or if you jump by a road and there's no pack at all involved. So it varies.
You mentioned that all of the smoke jumper material was manufactured at each base. Does that include the parachutes?
Well, they have the capabilities to, each base could make their own parachutes. But we go for a contract on that. It's a private industry manufactures the parachutes for us. And each year, or every 2 years, we send a want list to, it's all done right here at the administrative services right here in Missoula, which is Forest Service. And tell them we need 20 new parachutes. Maybe we burned 20 up. Maybe 10 have been burned up and 10 have been condemned because of age. Whatever the reason, we let them know we need so much, and then they go out and get a contract for it. And the other bases do the same thing. It's a consolidated order, and it's probably a little bit better because then you get them all made exactly the same. If you had each base making their own parachutes, knowing jumpers, none of them would be the same.
Right. Do you happen to know where these parachutes are manufactured?
Well, they depends on who the lowest bidder is.
Okay.
They'll send out a prospectus. It's a regular, it's for any kind of job. It's a contract with the government. They'll send it out to potential bidders. And I think we've had...
This is side two of an interview with Gary Johnson on July 21st, 1984. I'm going to ask Gary some questions about his work as a smoke jumper. During your career as a smoke jumper, have you ever worked as a spotter or a pilot?
Not a pilot, but a spotter.
Mm-hmm. How is a spotter selected to work?
Well, that it's usually your more experienced jumpers, and we've got a policy, again, down in Reading, that we only have our squad leaders, nobody below a squad leader spots on fires. We may have some of our older jumpers drop some practice jumps under a controlled situation, feeling that probably in a couple of years they may become a squad leader, therefore a spotter, that we don't have to spend a lot of time training them when they do reach that level. But they're picked out of all of our overhead down already are spotters. That's how we do it. And I don't know how about some of the other units. I think some of the other units may have some of their overhead that do not spot, and may have some of their non-overhead that do spot. But it's usually somebody that's been jumping for 6, 7, 8 years, and it's got a pretty good hit on his shoulders, and doesn't panic under pressure situations, to make good sound decisions. That's the kind of person you look for.
What do you think are some of the most difficult aspects of being a spotter?
Well, that's a hard question because it's a case by case situation. You're not talking about any one part of the procedure that's really that difficult, but if you, the situation, depends on what kind of situation you're in. You've got a plane load of jumpers you're trying to put on a fire, and there's a couple of air tankers, 4-8 bombers, flying around, and there's a helicopter, and there's maybe a couple other fixed wings buzzing around the place, and the radio is just going crazy. You got four different people trying to talk at the same time. Then it becomes kind of difficult and confusing. But the actual job itself, probably the most critical part of the job would probably be this selection of the jump spot.
Do you usually have radio contact with the smoke jumpers? Does the plane have radio contact
with the jumpers on the ground?
Right.
Yeah. We do. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I know there's some of the other units do not have the capabilities because they don't have enough radios. So they don't drop radios to small fires. Mm-hmm. And you don't, a radio isn't a necessity. We've got panels, you know, signal panels we can lay out and send messages up to the airplane. Mm-hmm. Down in California, we haven't had a situation where we've run out of radios yet, so we still have a radio for every fire. Mm-hmm. Which is sometimes good and sometimes bad.
Many of the smoke jumpers in Redding have an opportunity to go out on project work during the fire season?
No.
Is that because the fire season is usually a very busy one?
No, it's because we don't have a whole lot of jumpers.
Uh-huh.
The way we're set up with 40, so we have two aircraft down there.
Mm-hmm.
Both of them have been twin otters, and they will be for the next 3 years. Mm-hmm. And we carry 10 jumpers in each airplane. And so with 40 people, and we work, split them up so they work, we got 7 day coverage, try to get maximum people 7 days a week out of 40.
Mm-hmm.
So that ends up with about 26 or 27 on a day.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you figure you got to put 10 in each airplane, that's 20. And then we got to have spotters for the airplanes, that's say 24. That only leaves, and then you always have somebody on sick leave or somebody is sick, lame, or lazy.
Right.
And so we just don't have enough people on a daily basis to do project work. We get early project work in the springtime and late.
Mm-hmm.
Late project work, mm-hmm. slash burning. But during the hot part of the fire season, we're kind of hesitant to turn loose of any of our jumpers.
Mm-hmm. Are there on-base activities then?
No, we have work projects at Redding itself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a little background. Our base burnt down 3 years ago. I don't know if you knew about that or not.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, May 11th, 1981, a Forest Service aircraft crashed into our building, killed the four people. So we've been set up in a temporary facility, a maintenance hangar, for the last 3 years. And they have just completed the reconstruction of our facility. And so we've only been in it for about 3 months now.
Mm-hmm.
A brand new, it is the newest base now.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've been real busy with putting shelves up. And,
right.
And then there's a whole bunch of other construction going on out there at the Northern California Service Center. That's what the place is called,
mm-hmm.
NCSC. And there's all kinds of other stuff going on that the jumpers are involved in.
Mm-hmm.
Digging ditches, putting fence up, whatever. So we've had more than enough to keep us busy
mm-hmm.
for the last couple of years.
Hmm. You mentioned that you only use two aircraft, and those are twin otter
mm-hmm.
planes. Why is that? I mean,
why
those
do we have? Why don't we have more, or why don't we have less?
Why have you selected those two planes, or why have those planes been selected?
Well, a twin otter is a real good airplane for this work.
Mm-hmm.
To my knowledge, cost being a factor in it, it's probably the best aircraft available right now.
Mm-hmm.
It's get you down in canyons and get you back out, even on one engine. And the old DC-3s and some of the other aircraft couldn't do that. And it's a good platform for us, a real good platform for us to work on. We have two of them because it enables us to go two different directions at once. If they have some kind of passenger transport for it, they can take one. We still have an aircraft there for the jumpers to use. Several reasons why we've elected to go to twin otters.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that you're in a new base facility now. Do most of the smoke jumpers live on base?
No. We have a 25 person barracks. It's available, but it's probably about half full. Mm-hmm. And most of them live in an apartment. Reading is about the size of I'd say it's comparable to Missoula. Mm-hmm. That's 40,000-50,000. Mm-hmm. It's got motels and apartments and
right.
rentals, and there's a lot available there in town. And, first or second year jumpers will elect standard barracks, but it gets old mm-hmm. after a while.
To ask you if there's any particular aspect of smoke jumping in Redding, California that might distinguish it from other bases in the country.
Well, it's very seldom that we go a year through a season when we majority of our fires are small fires. I think last year was a unique year. We did, most of our fires were 2, 3, and 4-man fires. Normally, our small fires are early and late, and during the hot part of the season, we'll drop whole plane loads on fires. You don't go out and just jump a real small one snag fire. It's usually 10 people or even 20 jumping. Crew action jumps. And you can say that's attributed to we're farther south, it's dry down there. That's another thing that's unique about California is that our jumpers have to carry a lot of water, and that affects what we have to carry on the airplane and how we set up our cargo. Because there's no running water. You get up to a place like this, and about every draw or every other draw has water. But down in California, none of them have water in them. So you have to, anything you want, if you want drinking water, you have to take it with you. It's a pretty dry state.
Do you do very much para rescue work?
Oh, we've got some. We've got EMTs on the crew. Mm-hmm. Not really very much. We haven't had that much opportunity to do. We haven't had any plane crashes or that type of accidents happen. But we can do it. We've got all of everything set up for it, litters and all that, to do that. No, not a whole heck of a lot. Now, they've got other ways of doing it there. They've got a helicopter, CHP, California Highway Patrol, helicopter base right there at the airport. And there is a lot of roads in certain areas. There's a lot of places that don't have roads, but there are a lot of roaded areas in Northern California.
Do you work very often with heli-attack crews in fighting a fire?
No, not any more than having them pick up or retrieve our jumpers. Mm-hmm. As far as working on a project fire, mm-hmm. as helping them build sling loads and making water drops and stuff like that. No, not a lot, but we do. We one on one with them when they're coming in to pick up jumpers off a fire. Mm-hmm. That's probably all we do. Really. Mm-hmm. We don't make any. Each heli-attack or helicopter in Northern California has its own crew. They're manned 7 days a week with at least 5 people. We don't have to worry about supplying people for them.
The smoke jumpers that are working in Redding, California, come from many different regions of the country, or do most of your jumpers there come from California?
Most of them come from California. We probably have between out of 40, between 5 and 10 that are not from California, and they go back every winter to Oregon or to Ohio or wherever. But most of them are from California, and most of them have had California fire experience. We don't, we'll lean toward that if everything else is equal on hiring people. Everything else equal, and somebody's from back east and somebody's from California, we'll probably pick the guy from California because he's got the kind of fire experience that he's going to have to do the job.
Right. Are there any thoughts or experiences that you've had during your career as a smoke jumper that you would like to share with me, add to this tape?
No, I don't think so. Parting, if this is a parting thought, then I guess I would like, don't want to see the program get jeopardized. I think it. You've got a tremendous nationally. You've got a tremendous pool of ingenious, intelligent, hardworking individuals. That it's a unique outfit. You can't find. It's a very complex job that's done. You know, as far as especially safety wise, everything's got to be done just right by just the right person to make everything work right without hurting or perhaps killing somebody. And it's unique that you can do that. You can take smoke jumpers from Missoula, send them down to Redding. Everything works perfect. You can take Redding jumpers and send them up to McCall. Everything works perfect. You can take McCall jumpers and send them over to Redmond. I mean, that, you know, it just, and that's a unique part of the business. And it's, in this day of cutback management, I think that, that ought to be a strong consideration, and I don't want to see anything jeopardize the program because it is can do that kind of stuff for the Forest Service and for the American public, really.
What do you feel is one of the biggest threats then to the smoke jumper organization in the future that might jeopardize it?
Well, what I don't like is I don't like a bunch of folks that don't even know what the job is all about, and it's people that are that have a handle like that, they're affirmative action types, or they're personnel managers, or, and they don't know one end of a shovel from the other, and they certainly don't know anything about smoke jumping, and they're dictating to the, so to speak. This is me. Personal opinion.
Right.
They don't know what it takes to do the job, but they're trying to tell the people that do know what it takes to do the job, what kind of people it takes to do the job. And that's baloney. Mm-hmm. That's cool. And it's I don't know, I'll never get used to that. Mm-hmm. And I'm not going to roll over because I'm going to fight it as long as I can.
How much authority do people have over the smoke jumper organization now that really don't know what it takes?
Again, I can't speak for all the other bases.
Right, just for Redding.
For Redding, I'm kind of we're kind of in a green pasture, I guess. I've got it pretty nice because my boss is an ex-jumper, mm-hmm. and he's a fireman from the word go, and we think a lot alike, and I feel fortunate that I work for a guy like him, because things that make me mad make him even madder. Mm-hmm. So but he's his hands are tied too when somebody farther up the ladder says this is what you will do. We don't care how you do it or what it takes to do. His hands are tied too. So, I do have a little bit better. Now, some of the other units, I can only go on what I hear.
Right.
And I don't want to say anything that's hearsay.
Right.
But if what I've heard is true, I think I might don't think I'd be working for them.
Right.
You know, I've got personal principles that I have to live up to, and I couldn't put up with some of the stuff that I quote here, unquote, that has been going on.
Well, I'd like to thank Gary for being here in Missoula from California and for taking the time to share his thoughts and experiences as a smoke jumper with me. This is the end of this tape.